You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. I'm joined with our first guest in a while with Raw Nationals behind us and stuff. I feel like my yearly bronchitis is kind of behind me, and it's our first guest in probably a month, and it's going to be Josh Rohr. For some of you who don't know, Josh is a... How many times have you competed, Josh, at the national and world level? Three world championships?
Yeah, three world championships, and every nationals, or at least one nationals a year, every year since 2002, minus 2012 to 15, I believe. I took a little time off.
And those were all equipped, right?
Yes.
Okay. So for those that don't know, maybe if you could just go into a little a little background on who you are as a coach, as a lifter, and we'll go from there.
Okay. I guess my background, kind of how I got started in this sport, was actually in high school football in Ohio. It wasn't, you know, sanctioned or anything like that, but that kind of got me into the sport. First meet I ever entered, I won. So that kind of, you know, that's a good way to get you hooked. And then when I went to college at Ashland University in Ohio, I ran into another girl there that also competed in the Ohio high school stuff, and we ended up starting a club team there. And we went to collegiate nationals, and my first collegiate nationals was 2003. I lifted raw because I didn't know what equipment was, even though collegiate nationals at the time was only equipped. And I ended up, I think I placed sixth lifting raw. The following year, I put on gear and ended up winning collegiate nationals the following year. Bombed out in 2005 and then won again in 2006. So that was my one and only bomb out, was 2005. Knock on wood, hopefully that one time stands. And so, yeah, I competed at Junior Worlds in South Africa in 2004. Got fourth place in the Junior Worlds in 2006 in Bulgaria and got third place. And then I lifted at Open Worlds in 2009, and that was in India. I think I placed ninth that year. I don't even remember what the exact placing was, but I know I came in last. But it was Open Worlds, and you know, it's a rare opportunity to compete there. And I made the team as an alternate, so didn't want to pass up that opportunity. Coaching wise, I started coaching our collegiate team basically my freshman year, you know, knowing maybe just enough to be dangerous, but not really knowing that much, I guess. And my degree is in exercise science. So the further along we got in school, the better of a coach I became, I hope. And, you know, my senior year of college, we took four lifters to collegiate nationals, and three out of four of us won our weight classes. So we ended up as a team with only four lifters, we placed third at the collegiate nationals. That kind of upset some of the bigger teams, but you know, it is what it is. At the time you only scored six lifters. So when three of those placings won their weight class, it gives you some points. So fast forward, I guess after graduation, I moved down to Atlanta, Georgia, working out at Quest Nutrition and Athletics in Duluth, and I've been coaching powerlifters there ever since.
So I didn't realize that. So you grew up in Ohio.
Yep.
You're playing football, you're lifting some weights, and you realize, hey, I'm kind of good at this, and I kind of want to pursue this as an athletic endeavor. What did your training look like during that period of time?
You talking about in college?
Yeah, like when you first started, like the stupid shit that we all do when we first start.
Oh yeah. So in high school, yeah, I was doing everything, you know, from, you know, maxing out every day to going to failure on squats, like basically till I blacked out and just stupid. Like, it's a wonder, looking back, it's a wonder that I never hurt myself doing some of those stupid things. But, you know, high school kids, it's all about ego and who can outdo the other person. And, you know, any type of science-based training, you know, that doesn't make any sense to us because we're just, you know, driven by excitement and energy, and none of that matters. So, I think the, you know, once I got into college, I ran into Judd Logan. He's the track and field coach at Ashland. We actually, at the time, the club sports was using the same weight room as the track and field team. And so we were in there training basically alongside the track team. And basically, you know, I thought I was a big deal. For those of you that don't know Judd Logan, he's a four-time Olympian in the hammer throw. And I didn't know this, coming in. I just thought he was the track coach. So, you know, I'm bragging to him about, you know, I qualified for collegiate nationals, and this is prior to me actually, going to collegiate nationals. So at this time I haven't done anything in the sport. So I'm bragging to him about, you know, what I've done, and, you know, I'm like, you know, would you be willing to coach me and stuff like that? So, he actually, you know, credit to him, he actually, you know, offered to coach me alongside the track team my freshman year, for powerlifting. And, you know, I made pretty good progress, and, you know, obviously he has no obligation to that at all. So we basically followed kind of a West Side style, training program that year. He's really close with Louis Simmons and, you know, follows a lot of the West Side methodology. But then, moving into my sophomore year, Glenn Fincher, who is the chair of the exercise science department, he actually recently passed away. But at the time he was the chair of this, exercise science program. And he started doing my programming at that point. You know, obviously I was in the exercise science program, so I was trying to basically practice what I was preaching and learning and stuff like that. So we actually switched to more of a real low volume, high intensity program. And that's really where my lifts took off. And I think a lot of the reason it worked for me, was because, again, at the time I didn't mention this yet, but I grew up on a dairy farm. So in the summers I was doing a lot of manual labor. So I think, you know, when we think about volume, I was doing a lot of volume, especially for like my low back and things like that, just by working on the farm. But it wasn't until kind of later that I put the two and two together, why that low volume really worked for me. So, we did that, and like I said, lifts really took off. And, you know, now that I'm coaching primarily and not working on a farm, like obviously a lot of my assistants movements have had to increase in volume and things like that to continue to progress. But
what did that actually look like, that low volume? Like how many days a week were you squatting, benching, deadlifting?
So at the time, so we did play with that a little bit. The meet that I actually had my best results was the 2006 collegiate nationals. And, looking back through my training program leading up to that, I was actually squatting once every other week and deadlifting once every other week.
Was this always in the equipment?
Yes. Well, leading in, I'd say 9 weeks out, I was in equipment, but up till there it was raw. And you know, I was competing fairly often at that time, so I didn't need quite as much time and gear to kind of learn it, because I was in it fairly often. But yeah, so I would squat 1 week and deadlift the next week, and then squat the following week. And I was benching 3 times a week at the time, though.
So that's like the rotating is very like West Side influenced there with the squat 1 week, the deadlift the next. Yeah. When you were benching the 3 times a week, was there like one day where you kind of went like balls out and then kind of lighter towards the end of the week, or vice versa?
No. So most of the benching, it wasn't really any, I guess, balls out per se. There were certain days scheduled for that, but it wasn't 1 week was a max effort and 1 week was a dynamic or anything like that. It was really more of just a, you know, we were somewhere around 70 to 80% typically each workout. With an occasional, every other week we would hit a, a heavy double or single.
Would that be in the shirt, the heavy double or single?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the rest
within those nine, within those 9 weeks. Yes.
And then the rest would be raw the other days.
Yeah. Raw or a, or a board press, or I'm trying to remember. I don't have that.
Yeah.
Program in front of me, but I believe we were doing some board press at the time, even raw, because if anybody has ever watched me lift, my bench is not good. So we were doing everything we could to get that a little bit better.
Like, it's funny that you mentioned like working on the farm and how that was kind of taking up a good chunk of your volume. I've kind of learned. So my first 3 years in this sport, I was coached by Shaco, and we did a, kind of the exact opposite, right? Like high volume, lower intensity, lots of submax lifts. Right. But like some of those days were taking me, I mean, on a like higher volume day, like 3-4 hours to do. And like, I didn't have the time for that. So everything kind of like got condensed, and like my recovery wasn't necessarily the best. I was doing like similar things with like some of my lifters. We were doing more like high volume submax stuff. And when they're getting out of work at 5:30 at night, getting to the gym at 6:30 under a top set by like 7 o'clock, they just don't have that period of time. Like it starts like really cutting into recovery. It's like over time we've kind of switched. So we'll have like lighter days at the end of the week that are very, Shaco-esque, like number of lifts, sub max, like technique work type stuff. But we do like heavy singles and kind of get the fuck out of the gym. It's more efficient, time consuming. It allows them to live their lives outside of the gym a little bit. I think it's completely underestimated by coaches that like when we read a lot of this stuff, like what they do at Westside, a lot of those guys don't work. The lifters that Shaco had in Russia, they didn't work. They're state sponsored. So when you're dealing with regular people, I started working with Hartman about a year and a half ago. And I feel better if I lift heavier with less volume. I don't get as banged up, especially the older I get and stuff. Like I'm able to recover more, and I'm not sore from those heavier single days.
And I think that's you kind of touched on that. I think that's a big thing that is underestimated, I guess, is what else is going on in people's lives. Like, if you got somebody doing manual labor 8 hours a day, they're not going to come in and do 3 hours of real high volume stuff and make it through, Right. Versus if you got somebody that's, doesn't do any manual labor. I mean, they need more volume and more work to, keep their capacity up and things like that. So it's not cut and dry. This is the program everybody's going to do. It doesn't work like that. I mean, if it did, we would have a lot easier path as coaches.
Yes. 100%. So with your lifters that you have now, are they on a similar like lower volume, higher intensity type training program, or is it kind of all over the place depending on the person?
Yeah, it's all over the place. We do everything 100% from scratch for each of our lifters. So, we might have two lifters, same weight class, same, age, same experience level on a completely different training program just based on what, what their availability is for one, but also what their daily activities involve, So some that, like I said, are more active and doing other things, that all plays into what they can recover from. So, people like them, that are doing more manual labor or more activities, they're going to have a little bit, a little bit less overall volume, probably a little higher intensity, depending on, I guess, how often they're able to train too. So there's a lot of variables that go into it. It really, without really getting into all the specifics, it looks like total chaos when you compare the different types of training. Like it just looks like, so we have a joke on the team that I have a couple wheels on the wall at home with, one of them has different exercises, one of them has sets, one of them has reps, and basically spin the wheels and whatever it lands on, that's what they have. That's obviously not the case, but it is a fun joke we have. But yeah, everything is very, it's very specific to the individual. And coming from an exercise science background, the hard part for me has always been, you know, combining the science with what actually makes people tick and what they actually enjoy doing. So, you know, we can write a program out based on what's going on in your life that scientifically based is, you know, dead on the money. But if the person doesn't enjoy doing it and they're, you know, half-assing the effort, then, you know, that's not the best program for them. So that's kind of where the, you know, you always hear the programming is a lot of art just as much as it is science. You know, the more I'm doing this, the more I'm realizing that that actually is the case, which is, it's a hard pill to swallow coming from a science-based background. But, you know, again, results are results. You got to go with what's going to work the best for the individual.
Right. I have this this saying that I say to my lifters sometimes, that programs don't make good athletes. Athletes make programs look good.
Yeah. You know what? I like that.
And like you said, it's a chaotic system, right? It's not linear. And like, even that same person that like does manual labor or that doesn't do manual labor, they may have these certain outside stressors that come up over time. Like I have Alyssa, who does the podcast, like she'll edit this and stuff. She's getting her PhD. There's going to be some semesters for her that are a little bit more grueling on her, and her work in the gym or her recovery or whatever it may suffer a little bit. So it's going to be flexible and adaptable to the individual. One of the things that I've kind of learned over time, because I was very similar, where everybody would be on a completely different program, and they still are now. So our exercises are just kind of like based off of technical inefficiencies, weaknesses, whatever it is. But and the volume, so later in the week where the volume shift and stuff, it's going to be completely dependent upon the person, how many days they train a week. But I realized over time, like, I needed to have some type of like sound structure, or I was going to like lose my mind, like trying to keep track of everybody. So we have this, like, this kind of set structure where we run a conjugate type of system. So you're going to have your max effort stuff. You're going to have we don't do a ton of like West Side dynamic effort stuff. It's more like technical rep work type stuff. And like, those things are just going to kind of move around based off of your general needs. And they have rules. Like, if certain things are happening or we're watching the max effort lifts and RPEs are starting to slide up a little bit, we'll, the following week, instead of a max effort week, we'll take some type of rep work. So we'll take a certain percentage off of the previous week's max work, hit it for some reps, and just like move on for recovery and stuff. So it kind of like, even though there's a set structure, it's flexible and adaptable for each person that's lifting within it. And I don't think, you know, this is where the value of coaching comes from. It's not actually like writing the program. It's making those daily adjustments per the individual, and like that kind of like relationship you form with them in order to do those things. And I don't know. It's like one of my Excel spreadsheets aren't coaches, basically, is kind of like right. what I'm trying to get to. So, you know, with that said, it sounds like you have, you know, good communication with your lifters. You'd have to, or you wouldn't be able to write the programs like that. How many lifters do you have?
Right now we're coaching about 35. And I have two other coaches that work for me as well, or work with me, I guess is a better way to put it. Laura Sturm and James Vang. They do some of the programming and stuff as well. James is actually getting ready to go to Open Worlds in Dubai. This week, actually, or end of this week, I think. So,
how many of the 35 are raw and how many are equipped?
So I would say it's about a 2/3 split. Probably 2/3 are raw. Obviously I come from an equipped background, so I'm trying to get everybody to try it a little bit. And we've got some more lifters getting into the gear, and really enjoying it. But, to be honest with you, we actually use the gear, for some of our raw lifters, because especially if there's inconsistencies in their technique, when you put on the gear, those inconsistencies are magnified. So, you know, for example, you know, the bar path on the bench, I have a couple of my raw lifters that we put them in a bench shirt for training. Because when you get a little inconsistent lowering the bar, I mean, it's going to shoot it one way or the other and you're going to miss badly. but it also reinforces the good positioning because it makes it so much easier when you hit that groove just right. So we've actually found that, you know, training in the equipment has actually really helped our raw lifters as well, even though they're not competing in the gear.
So when you put them in the bench shirt, just like a medium fit type thing.
Yeah. We don't go crazy tight. But you know, it's enough that it really puts their technique under a magnifying glass. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the goal of it for me, is to make them realize what they're doing, because now they're feeling it way more. So it helps, you know, it's been helping a lot.
What I really like about that idea too, of like raw lifters hopping in the equipment at times, is that like that psychological component of seeing heavier weights on that bar.
Yeah, that definitely is a factor as well, for sure.
And like, I know for me, so I just started, Hartman and Cooper finally broke me down, and I started getting into the equipment like 2 months ago, maybe. And I think
just for clarity, you're talking about Jeremy Hartman and Zach Cooper.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that, like, so I put my straps up for the first time like 2 weeks ago on a deadlift, and you know, hit a little PR. And the first thought that came into my head when I put that bar on the ground was, "Holy shit, that would just be so much easier raw, because I could just like grab the bar and set up, and I should be able to lift it." Like, it's actually like taught me how to, I think, build pressure a little bit more, or handle the pressure a little bit more, be a little bit more patient. Like, I think outside of even just like bar path and like the psychological component of it, I kind of feel it slowed me down a little bit for, I haven't been lifting raw much because I'm doing my first equipped meet in a few weeks. But like when I actually do some lighter raw work, I just feel that, like you were saying, like my positions are much better. I'm more patient. My control's better. So I definitely see that benefit. I remember I had a very brief conversation with Mike DeShera about raw lifters training and equipment. He said it'll help some, it'll probably not help others and stuff. Is that kind of like a similar thing that you see?
Yeah, I think the biggest benefit I see in using the equipment is really the shoring up the technique stuff. You know, cause a lot of times, you know, with raw lifting, you cannot be perfect in your technique and still muscle it up. With the equipment, if you're not perfect with your technique, like, you basically have zero shot at it. So, you know, we want to take that precision into our raw lifting as well and make it a priority, because that is going to give you the extra 2.5 or 5 kilos on your bench or whatever. Right. And, you know, in a powerlifting meet, every kilo counts. So, why just take good enough when we can get better? And sometimes, you know, the gear is a way to, you know, it's another coach, because, you know, I can tell you you're being inconsistent. I can tell you focus more on bracing, you know, keeping your upper back tight, but why not just put the shirt on and feel it and learn it yourself, like how to do that. So
will you have the lifters squat with like suit bottoms or a suit?
Not as much, because a lot of that is, I feel like there's a lot of change in terms of execution with that. I mean, the suit is going to want to pull your knees in. It's going to want to make you buckle over a little bit in the beginning. And a lot of times that's not, I mean, if that's an issue our lifters are having, then yeah, that would be something I'd be open to, but I have not done that to this point. It's mostly just been the bench shirt.
I guess the technique would be a little bit different too, right? For sitting back as opposed to sitting down more.
Yeah. So during the actual execution, if you're watching it, it would be the same, but your focal point, yeah, you actually have to push back into the suit a little bit more. And then when you try to do that raw, then you end up sitting back too far and getting bent over. So I don't think that translates as much as the bench shirt does. But again, there's, you know, if you want to talk about the overload factor that you mentioned earlier, then yeah, that's absolutely, you know, an option you can go with. But, you know, I primarily am using the gear with the raw lifters just to reinforce the technique of everything. So, you know, that, like I said, I don't know that the, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know that the squat suit would necessarily, do that as efficiently as the bench shirt does for the bench.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And I guess if you wanted to overload the squad, you could just wrap knees. You wouldn't have to get in the suit and do that much different stuff.
Yeah.
So one of the well, actually, you know what? With the raw totals going up yesterday by quite a bit, you think you'll see more people jump in the equipment?
You know, I would like to see that, but honestly, the raw totals went up last year. And so I think we had right around 1,100 2 years ago. The qualifying totals went up. Everybody is saying, well, we'll probably be down to like 800 or 900. And then we had 1,300 this year. So I don't know that that's going to make that much difference. I think a lot of the people that, you know, maybe on paper right now cut out of Raw Nationals because of that, I think they're still close enough that they can get stronger and qualify by next year. So, I don't know. I would like to see more people get into equipment. But you know, we'll just have to wait and see. That's my theory. I mean, I guess I agree with you in that. That's my theory, is that if this keeps getting, the totals keep getting higher and higher, and you know, there's still more people getting into the sport, that eventually maybe some people will give the gear a try. And you know, at least around where I'm at in Georgia, we got a couple coaches that are, so James Townsend is one of the coaches in Georgia, that he's actually the head coach of the Open team that's equipped. So he's got a lot of people that he's getting into gear as well. And you know, we're seeing a lot of raw lifters around Georgia trying out the gear. So maybe that'll take off nationwide, hopefully.
I think, I'm not sure if the totals will do it. Part of me thinks it might. Part of me thinks other people just lift in a federation where it's easier to compete in a nationals, if that's really what they want to do. But like,
yeah, that's one of my pet peeves. Go ahead though.
So like, I don't know, like any national event that I've ever been a part of in another sport should be like, it should be hard to get to. You shouldn't be able to train for a year and a half and then just step foot on a national level platform. Like I love the fact that they're increasing the totals. I think it's going to feel a lot more like the Arnold than it's going to feel like nationals has been in the past. And that back warm-up room is fucking chaos at nationals.
Yeah, it can get pretty crowded. But you know, everybody's basically playing with the same playing field, because it's crowded. Yeah. But there's, you know, it's crowded for everybody.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think in part too, like it's great for the growth of the sport, because more people go there, which means they're going to send their family and friends the live stream. More people watch it. So like, I get the benefits of having more people there, and I go back and forth on it, but I think a more competitive nationals will be more fun for everybody involved. And when you actually get to go, it'll be, a better experience.
And I think, you know, I think the totals are closing in on that now. Like I was looking at them, last night or today, I guess, cause they just came out. But you know, I think they're at a point now, like if you hit those totals, like you're legit. And there's, you know, there's a lot of power lifters in the sport now. So, you know, we're still gonna have a big nationals, but looking at those totals, like they're pretty damn high. So, you know, if you hit those totals, like, you know, to me, you deserve to go. So,
you know, I have a lifter in Germany who texted me this morning talking about the new qualifying totals. So for the 105s, which is the weight class that he competes in, only the winner of nationals would qualify in America. Like, that's pretty cool that how strong this country is in the sport of powerlifting. And, you know, I think it shows that more people are getting into the sport, which
yeah,
I think,
and that's,
no, sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, so I was going to say, like, that's, you know, using that example, that's kind of where I get frustrated with, I guess, the mentality of a lot of lifters. Like, you know, for example, if you don't hit that qualifying total, you know, so like you mentioned, people might go lift elsewhere so they can lift at nationals. Like, what's the point of that? Like, be proud of what you're doing numbers wise. Like, why do you have to go, you know, I might get in trouble here, but I might, you know, why do you have to go get an arbitrary title because, you know, you're lifting against or at a competition where there isn't competition.
You're cheapening your results.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, that's, you know, that's just one of those things, like, you know, if you get 20th place at Raw Nationals, like, great. Like, that's great. Like, why do you have to downplay that and be like, oh man, you know, I got 20th, you know, I'm going to go lift somewhere else where I can medal. You know, it's like, I just don't get that.
And
that's my little rant.
No, I love it. And that's like, you know, one of the things that I really try to, like, I'm lucky enough for the majority of my people are actually like in person. So we have a really good training environment. And like when everybody saw those totals go up yesterday, people are like texting me what they're going to hit. And like people are going to the gym and just like literally just getting after it more than they've got after it before. Cause it's like, hey, this 20 kilos aren't going to just be added to my total overnight, you know? So like, I think, you know, having that type of bar is going to make people train harder, and it's going to push the top tier of lifters in this country to be even stronger. Yeah. But I also think too, like with the growth of the sport, like me, I get bored with raw lifting. I just like, I'm coaching it all day long. I'm like trying to do the same thing myself. And it's just like, I can't fucking do this anymore. So like getting in the equipment for me was just like the next logical step. It's just, I was interested in it. It's like being a beginner all over again. So you're like excited. You're trying to learn things. You're, you know, I'm like, it's fun again. Like, you know, and I think a lot of people will be in that same boat where they're, you know, they'll be raw lifting 3, 4, 5 years. And it's just like, hey, I kind of want to do something different. Let me throw on a shirt or whatever, you know, whatever.
I mean, I think that goes back to, I mean, just from a bigger, you know, broader perspective, I mean, that goes back to the art of the training, even, you know, if you're getting bored with it, regardless whether it's raw, regardless whether it's equipped, whatever, like you need some sort of change. Cause if you're not enjoying it, what the hell's the point?
That's a good point.
You know, so, you know, I think, you know, that's something, you know, like you said, throwing in the gear, you know, maybe changing, you know, if you've been doing a higher volume, lower intensity training program like Shaco, then maybe you need to switch to, you know, do a block of high intensity, low volume, just for something different, you know? You know, on paper, again, it might not be what's ideal, but you can't underestimate that psychological side of it. Like if you're just not putting in the effort, not enjoying it, then I don't care what program you're doing, it's wrong.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And that's why, like, I think training environment's so important. Like lifting weights with your friends should be fun regardless of what you're doing.
And I think you can put a lot of that, you know, on, you know, the programming as well. And like what you just said, the communication with the coach and the programming, because, you know, if you as an athlete are not communicating back to the coach that, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm having a hard time getting into it, you know, whatever, you know, one, the coach is going to say, hey, man the fuck up and get after it. And if that makes you tick, then that works. You know, and there's, you know, I have athletes like that. You just cuss them out a little bit, and you know, everything's good to go. Other people, you know, they need a change because, you know, they need that different stimulus to stay interested. Well, as a coach, you need to listen and hear that. If they're telling you that, if you just ignore it, then, you know, you're doing a disservice to them. So, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot of different ways to skin a cat. And if you're trying to get, you know, people bought into it and enjoying the process, then you need to be able to listen to what the athletes are telling you as a coach and make those adjustments. So
I like that a lot. When you first got into the equipment, what was the equipment like back then compared to what it's like now?
So my first bench shirt was a heavy duty blast shirt from Inzer. That thing was miserable to get into. It cuts you under the arms pretty good. Ironically, I got a lot out of it because it allowed you to be a little sloppy technique wise and still get stuff out of it. Like the new shirts from like Titan and stuff. Now you got to be a lot more precise. But you can, you know, once you get that technique locked in, you can, you know, get more out of it. But I was never, you know, early on, I didn't have very good technique, especially in the bench press. So, you know, those shirts that were a little more forgiving actually worked pretty good for me early on. But, you know, in the long term, looking back, they didn't really do me a lot of good because it didn't require me to fine tune stuff. So, you know, now the bench shirts, you know, they're a lot more advanced, and I actually haven't worn even some of the top of the line shirts, like the Katanas and stuff like that from Titan. I have worn them, I guess, but I haven't necessarily gotten really good at them yet because, I guess to throw myself under the bus a little bit, I'm not strong enough to lock out, as much weight as it requires to touch in some of those shirts. So I actually still wear a Titan Fury bench shirt is my go-to shirt for myself.
So the Katana is just the way it's stitched is just way tighter, right?
Well, it's, I don't know if tighter is the word. It's more aggressive. So you're going to get, you know, I guess if you use like, you know, like squatting against, mini bands versus squatting against, you know, monster bands, neither one of them necessarily stretch more or less. They just have a lot more resistance during the stretch. So okay. It's kind of the same concept, I guess.
And the technique in them would be the exact same.
I think so. I would say that the more aggressive the shirt is, the more the technique plays a role.
Okay. So throw you around more, right?
Yeah. So if you get a little bit out of the groove, it's going to kind of force you one way or the other more aggressively. So, you know, I would say technique is more of a deal or a bigger deal. Technique's always a big deal, but you know, the tighter, you know, I would say you got to be a little bit more precise with a Katana than you do a Fury.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense actually. So I know you pulled around 700 pounds at 165 pounds. What was your best?
I've never pulled seven. I had an inch off the ground one time, but never actually pulled.
What was your best deadlift in a meet?
672. I've pulled that in two different meets.
So what's your best raw deadlift?
My best raw deadlift is I pulled 635 raw.
Okay. Because like when I was looking at your like the lifting database, I was like, I wonder how much he's getting out of a deadlift suit. Cause I feel that's like the one that people tend to not get so much,
And I actually do. I don't know if I'm an exception or what the deal is, but I feel like I get quite a bit out of it. So, you know, a lot
Why
of people
do you think
say,
that I get, is?
You know, I'm not sure.
That's not helping me.
Well, I think part of it is, off the floor has always been my, so I pull, I started out competing conventional and I switched over to sumo, and off the floor is always my issue. And I've always, I guess from a technique standpoint, I think deadlift's always been kind of my, what I technique wise, I'm the best at. So I think being able to get into that, you know, perfect position with the suit, kind of that's what really helps, I think, because the suit's going to help you off the floor if you're locked in correctly. And, you know, that being my weak part of the lift, the suit helps off the floor. That's kind of, you know, as long as you can maintain that technique, it's going to help. So, and I'm built to deadlift versus bench. I got, you know, shorter torso, long arms. So, you know, that obviously helps too.
Yeah. I'm built the same way. And like the deadlift is my strongest lift. But, you know, I'll have that, like, at times, like, my hips rising up off the floor, which doesn't happen in the suit. What did you wear to deadlift in?
Velocity from Titan.
Okay. Because, like, right now I'm just wearing my same Centurion normal stance squat suit to deadlift in. And I'm noticing that, like, my hips will stay down, but I am, like, round as fuck trying to get out of that bar.
And I think that's the thing. Like, people always think a tighter suit is going to be better, or a thicker suit's going to be better. And that's not always the case. You know, like I said, the Katana is a better bench shirt, but it's not for me because I'm not good enough to use it the way it needs to be used. So for me to put on wear a Katana and bench less than if I was wearing a Fury is just stupid. So you could do one of two things, you know, wear the Fury or, you know, get better and wear the Katana. And I'm not to that point yet. So, you know, I've been doing this since, 2002, and I'm still not there yet. So, you know, it's a process.
To me, that's the biggest draw of equipped lifting is when, so like Hartman was telling me that, and this wasn't even that long ago, that, you know, he went somewhere and his wife was getting in the deadlift suit and he learned something about the suit that day, even though he's been doing it for as long as what he was. And that right then I was like, this is something that I can get into. Like just the fact that there's always that, like that learning curve. So I'm assuming the Titan Velocity is thinner than what a squat suit would be.
Yeah, it's thinner. And so you can, you know, typically wear it a little bit tighter because it's thinner. So it gives a little bit more. So it gives you kind of a little bit more support through a larger range of motion than if you wear a, you know, at least for me, than if I was to wear a squat suit while I'm deadlifting, because then you got to maybe leave the straps a little bit looser so you can get down to the bar. But then, you know, halfway up, it starts letting off because it's, you know, you can't, it's not as tight. So
that's actually exactly what, so I can actually lock out like from my knees, like the difference between what I can get to my knees and what I can lock out from my knees is about 100 pounds. So it's, like if I can get it to my knees, I can lock it out. So like, but my biggest struggle is just staying in positioning and getting down to the bar. Like I have to round my back to make my arms longer. I can't actually grab the bar. And there are times where it's like in my fucking fingertips and yeah. Like you're just holding on for dear life.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, I was actually working with somebody yesterday. You know, they're a raw lifter. It was actually their first day in the gym. And, you know, they were having the same issue. Like they couldn't get their back flat and feel like they were in a good position. And, you know, they're asking if their back is weak and all these other things. And, you know, I guess what was happening was they just weren't able to make that mind body connection of how to engage the rear delts and lock the lats in place. You know, so we just spent, you know, 10 minutes doing, you know, different little exercises like a, you know, a lat pull down and just, you know, me tickling their armpit and saying, okay, squeeze my fingers under your armpit, just stuff like that. And I'm like, now do you feel what muscles are contracting? Yes. Okay. Now we're going to go back into deadlift and I want you to contract those same muscles. And boom, that fixed the issue. Obviously that's, you know, it was day one. So, you know, it's, you know, other issues are going to pop up. That issue may reoccur, but a lot of times it's as simple as, you know, making sure that the athlete can understand how to do what you're trying to tell them to do. I think that's one thing that, you know, is important is being able to communicate and I guess for lack of a better term, teach, you know, what we're actually trying to do when we say, you know, fix this or fix that.
I actually like how you give them that experience, right? You don't just kind of like say those words, you actually say those words, but give them an experience so that they can actually like relate it to the lift itself. That's learning, right? That's what you're, you know,
yeah. And I'm a big believer in effective cues. But that being said, I think 90% of the cues that people are using in the gym are just what they've heard other people say. Yeah. So, you know, they're not actually effective necessarily. So, you know, things like, you know, big breath, push on your belt, you know, push on your heels, all those things are effective cues when used appropriately, but just throwing them out there for just as things to say, it doesn't make sense. You know, so we always try to find, you know, specific exercises or whatever, that translate to what we're trying to do. So I can say, you know, like one of the cues that I like to use is, in a squat, if their knees are buckling, like instead of saying knees out, that's kind of arbitrary if somebody doesn't know what it means to push their knees out. So I'll have a lifter squat down and pause in the bottom and I'll put my hands outside of their knees and just hold them like an inch away from their knees and say, touch my hands. So they have to spread their knees until their knees touch my hand. So now when they're squatting, my cue to them is touch my hands, not push your knees out, because they actually have something to translate that to what that means.
Right. They can focus on that like external feeling that hand on their
knee. That's just one example. And I think that's, you know, that's across the board for all the lifts. I mean, finding something, you know, like it doesn't matter what it is. If it's, you know, tippy toes, if that makes a lifter do something, if that means something to them, then that's the cue you use. So
Absolutely. And I think one thing that like is important with that, like squat example, is slowing them down.
Yep.
All right. So I think in a lot of cases, like, especially with newer raw lifters, the squat tends to be the thing that like freaks them out the most. And so like, I call that like from the hole to a couple inches up, the oh shit zone in the squat, because that's what people are like, oh shit. And like, if you can just teach people to slow down and control their positions, like one of the things that like I really learned from Shaco was using exercises that just like punish those inefficiencies. So we might do like a pause on the halfway up as opposed to in the hole if somebody's knees are caving in. Cause if they collapse forward and the knees cave in, they won't be able to pause in that earlier position. Yeah. So over the course of doing reps, they'll have to figure it out.
Absolutely. That's a big part of our programming is, you know, spending more time in that deficient range of motion, you know, whether it's a technique flaw or whether it's a physical weakness there, either way, you know, if you're spending time there, so like, you know, use the example of the pause, you know, if you typically lose your positioning halfway up in the squat, well, if now you're pausing in the squat halfway up, like if you're losing your position, you're going to lose your balance or fall if you're staying there. So it forces you to be aware of what's happening and correct it.
Right.
So I definitely like that strategy.
And it slows you down in those positions. We'll do a ton of overload work from those positions too. So we might do like high box squats or high pin squats or just so that they can like strengthen those same angles, changes the strength curve a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, what I noticed too is like when people get scared in that squat, and this is why I like the heavy singles, like it addresses that psychological component. You learn how to compete, you learn how to not be scared, not throw a temper tantrum if you miss a rep.
Yeah.
Is when they get a little nervous, they start to lose speed, like going down. It'll be like good speed halfway, and then they just like slam on those brakes, and then everything just like falls apart. You know, I think that's where like something like how you had mentioned that you were like you use the equipment sometimes, like maybe even something like knee wraps, right, where you get a little bit of rebound out of the hole and you learn how to like hit the hole.
It encourages you to stay aggressive because it actually helps you more that way. So then it kind of starts resetting that psychological side of it. Like, oh, aggressive or you know, still being under control, but being more aggressive is going to make it easier. It kind of just reinforces that mindset.
Right. Exactly. And like, I was just thinking about like what you said, if you had a lifter whose knees kind of cave in and you put them in the equipment, I've always had this like little twitch in my knees when it gets a little heavier. And I'm trying to think, like, since I've been in the equipment and I've done my raw stuff, granted they've been like, I've done like pause box squats and stuff like that. So I've been like slowing down and obviously that limits the load a little bit, but I do think it has actually helped with that a little bit, or maybe even just the wider stance, right? If I'm in a wider stance with flats, I'm sitting back more, it's going to hit my hips a little bit more. And maybe that's helping keep my knees out too. But, I don't know. I'm just kind of like rambling after what you had said earlier. If you had somebody under those circumstances with the squat, and I think there could be some. And I think too, like, I don't know, maybe even like, I know a lot of lifters, and I wonder if I want to get your opinion on this. They say that like lifting and equipment actually kind of increase the time length of their careers. Like they feel healthier doing it. I know like Blaine Summers, one that said that, I mean, you look at like the WPO that was just on ESPN. I know it's multi-client stuff, but like a lot of those guys are in their, you know, late 30s, early 40s, and they're still lifting and they're still lifting big weights. Is that something that like you see some benefit into like the longevity using equipment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, time will tell. You know, raw being still fairly new, I mean, we don't know how long some of these careers are going to go for some of these, you know, top raw lifters now. So we can speculate. But I think to definitively say, you know, equipped lifters are going to have more longevity than raw lifters, I don't think we can definitively say that. Theoretically, yeah, I think that is true. But I don't think we have enough, I guess, data at this point, because, you know, most of the lifters that have been competing raw, I mean, roughly started, what, 2008, 2009. So, you know, we're going on 10 years right now. Some of these other lifters have been going for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years already. So you know, I think we need more time to say for sure. But I know from myself my personally, you know, every time I've been a little banged up or had some injuries, like the gear allows me to continue to train without flaring up those injuries. So based on that, I would say, yes, I think it's going to help, with longevity, but you know, I think time will tell.
So, I mean, there's obviously like so many variables that go into longevity, right? Like even like something like staleness with training, right? If you get bored, you're going to quit.
Yeah.
So like something different, but why
yeah, do you think- and it's going to matter too. Like, you know, if you do have a little tweak or a little injury, like if you just ignore it versus if somebody's smart enough to actually address it, you know, so
right.
it's going to be individual based too. I mean, I can do something stupid in the gym tomorrow and never address it and, you know, be injury plagued the rest of my life. Or, you know, I can be smart, address it, fix it and, you know, be fine. So I think, you know, that's going to depend on the individual some too, and what their longevity is, if they're disciplined and smart enough to take care of themselves.
That's a very good point. So, you know, theoretically, well, let's talk theoretically. I mean, all of this is theory anyways. You think just because of the compression of the actual gear, like keeping the joints safe, or do you think because equipped lifters, so I know like the explosion of raw lifting also like started this explosion of like that RPE 6 lifestyle where you're just doing a shitload of volume all the time and increasing volume at pretty high rates. Equipped lifters don't lift with that amount of volume, but they lift higher absolute loads. So like my theory is like the equipped lifters last longer because they just don't do a shitload of volume. Like for me, the volume just beats me up. So there's my bias, but, or I mean, it could be a combination of the compression plus all of that stuff, but I'm curious your thoughts on why you think it would increase longevity.
Well, I agree with what you just said too. You know, I think the trend right now is the real high volume stuff and, you know, I think it has its purpose, but I do think it, you know, will wear you out over time. So, you know, I think it's all of that. It's, you know, the compression does kind of keep everything, you know, supported joint wise and everything, but it also, you know, again, going back to the precision of technique, it all forces right. you to be a little bit more deliberate with your technique. So, you know, you're not going to get the wear and tear as much on the knees if you're keeping them, you know, in line with your toes and whatnot. So I think all of that, I don't think it's just one magical reason. I think it's just all of it encompassed, like, you know, overall, probably less volume with equipped lifters, you know, probably a little bit more efficient technique, probably, you know, just being more aware, you know, when you have, you know, a raw squat of 500 and an equipped squat of 600, you know, that 600 is going to, you know, hit you a little harder, I guess. So you're more aware when maybe things don't feel right and maybe address them a little bit more versus if it's raw, like, well, I'm a little bit, you know, banged up, but I'll go ahead and train anyway. I don't know. I guess I don't have an exact answer there. I think it's a lot of those factors, and you know, it still to me comes back to the individual, like being smart enough to recognize what's sore versus what's injured.
Right. And like I think too, the psychological awareness, knowing there's 100 more pounds on the bar, you're a little more in tune to what you need to accomplish for that rep. I think one go ahead.
So that actually just made me think of something. So what I've been finding recently is, you know, as my lifters are getting stronger, they're, you know, they've traditionally, you know, doing their warm-up sets, just kind of been, you know, essentially going through the motions. And then when they get to their work sets, they really, you know, dial in. Well, now that they're getting stronger, their warm-up sets are much heavier. And, you know, what might have been a working set is now a warm-up set, but they're still treating it like a warm-up set. So if their technique gets a little bit off, you know, when you're warming up with, you know, 95 pounds in the squat, you know, you can get a little bit off and be okay. But now when your warm-up set is 185 and you're a little bit off, that's going to really mess with you. So I think part of that, you know, what you alluded to with the equipment being locked in and focused, I think that, you know, maybe applies too, because you have to do everything just right in gear, you know, warm up or not, to to not biff, basically. So, you know, that's one thing that, you know, I've been trying to make a priority with all my lifters now is, you know, I don't care if it's a warm-up set, you got to treat it like it's heavy weight because it is heavy weight. You know, it might be easy, but it's still heavy and it can do damage if you're not paying attention. So, you know, I think that's, you know, maybe that's part of it too, is having a little bit more, I guess, lax focus on the warm-ups with, you know, technique maybe not being as good can cause some wear and tear also. I don't know.
No, we have this thing in the gym, no reps off. Like a lot of your top sets are missed or not executed properly, and they're missed long before that top set even got there. It's because you've been fucking around during your warm-ups, not getting in tune to the weights, not, you know, going through the process, especially when you're taking a heavy single, you know. And I think that's important. And one of the, just like backtracking a little bit to the volume, because this thought came into my head. So I worked with Shaco for 3 years. My volume only went up as my one rep max went up. But if we were just looking at volume, if our definition was just number of lifts, my number of lifts did not change over the course of that period of time. So for 3 years, I mean, obviously there's like a little bit of fluctuation, but they stayed within a given range for a 3 year period of time. And of course, like the workload, so if we're talking like sets times reps times weight type of thing, that increased over time because I was getting stronger, but the actual number of lifts I was performing in the gym stayed the exact same. So I think, you know, what I tend to see out there anyways is people have this tendency to freak out a little bit if, you know, the process doesn't seem to be so linear as they would like it to be. And so it's like, oh, I'm kind of stuck. I need to increase volume. And for me as a coach, I don't increase in volume is one of the last things that I do. Like we'll look at technique first. We'll assess weaknesses within the lifts. We'll manipulate other training variables, and volume's like something that kind of comes on later on. We'll increase it towards the meat a little bit. But I tend to see a lot more of that stuff out there. And like, I just remember like Shaco having these like volume recommendations, and like one day just for like my own fun, like taking some lower level lifters and just looking at the volumes, and like their number of lifts were up where like almost a master of sport would be in one of his programs for the volumes. And I wonder if that has something to do with the longevity of, I know most lifters just, how many raw lifters, I'm trying to think of how many raw lifters I can think of that have been around 10 years competing at a high level. And there's not that many. But yeah,
in general, I think raw lifting's only really been around 10 years. So, you know, it's hard to, to find that. And I think, I don't know. I mean, we're saying the same things. It's, you know, you can get away with not having, you can get away with technique flaws in raw lifting a little bit easier than you can equipped. So maybe that's, you know, maybe that's something that we'll look at, you know, in another 10 years when we find some people that have been around 20 years, if they're starting to have, you know, hip issues, knee issues, things like that. You know, we just have to wait and see, I guess.
Yeah. No, that's good point. I mean, it's always fun to theorize and think about some of those things. So you have one lifter competing at Open Worlds in Dubai next week?
He's actually one of our coaches. Yeah, he's lifting in Dubai next week.
Is it his first world championship?
No, he's been to quite a few.
Okay. What is that experience like going to Worlds? This is kind of like the last question I have, then I'll let you go. Like as a lifter and as a coach, because you've done both, right?
Yeah, I've done both. As a lifter, it sometimes it becomes bigger than it is, I guess. At least that was my experience. I put it out there as, you know, this much bigger deal than it was. And I'm not downplaying it, but I guess how my mind worked, like everything revolved around that for like months leading up to. And I think in the moment when I got there, I underperformed because I made too much, I guess, I got out of my norm. I let it dictate my mentality, everything else. And I think that's one of the things with experience, you know, the more you do it, the more, you know, it's it's obviously still a very freaking big deal. But keeping it in context, like, you know, you still can only control what you can control. So, you know, worrying about, you know, the Russian lifter, or worrying about, you know, what the other coaches are doing or whatever, just, you know, stay in your world. And that's, I guess that's where, you know, coming into the coaching side of it, you know, when I have lifters, you know, I had a lifter, Chris Elmore just lifted at Masters Worlds for the first time, in September. And, you know, it's his first Worlds, and, you know, he's getting a little bit, you know, excited for good reason. But, you know, at one point I decided to tell him, I'm like, look, I go, don't start letting this whole experience become bigger than the actual powerlifting meet, because you're going to, and you're starting to make it this whole other thing. Like, you just need to focus on what you do when you go lift. And, you know, I think that kind of maybe changed the way he was thinking a little bit. You know, again, not to downplay the event, but at the end of the day, you're going to compete in a powerlifting meet. Like, that's what it is. So don't make it, you know, bigger than that, where it affects you.
Right. You put some extra psychological pressure on yourself in training. You make some poor decisions.
Yeah. Or you might, you know, if you're a little bit banged up, you're like, well, it's the world championships. I got to push through. And then you hurt yourself. And, you know, what good does that do? You know? So.
Right. No, that's a great point. I think that's just like good advice for lifting in general.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of live in the moment.
Yep.
I think that's a good place to end on, Josh. I appreciate you coming on. Let everybody know where they can find your stuff on the internet. You're pretty active on social media.
I'm trying, you know, I'm not real good at it, but I'm trying to get better at it. That seems to be the trend, that you got to go now. So, yeah, you can find me, I guess on all the social medias at Team Roar. It's TEAMROHR, and teamroar.com.
Awesome. Again, thanks, Josh. I appreciate you coming on. Guys, you can follow me on Instagram. It's KW Can, our team, Precision Powerlifting Systems. Stay strong, Boston.